All right, so you did Habakkuk, right? And how many of you, I think I asked you last time, but I want to get another hand count. How many of you had previously studied Habakkuk before? Just a few had really studied it, okay? So what did you learn this time through? What struck you about the story? You remember, we'll jump right into what the assignment was. What was the challenge to faith in Habakkuk? What was it that was going on in Habakkuk's life that he saw that would have threatened his faith and maybe caused him to doubt whether he could really trust in a loving or just God? What were his circumstances? Okay, there was idolatry going on, but what was it about that that would challenge his faith? Yeah. Right, so he's thinking about the Babylonians, which are the Chaldeans, also known as, and they're coming, right? So that's actually the second part of the discussion. What was the first thing? That makes sense for the second one. How about right at the beginning also? That's not wrong at all, but it's half of it. Yes? So he doesn't see the Lord working because the people are continuing on in their idolatry and things like that. And, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it seems like things are just being left to go their way, right? How about you, James? What did you have to add?
Same thing.
All right, so what we have idolatry going on, and God seems to be permitting it, not doing anything about it, not judging it. What else? What else was happening? Yeah, Brandon. Okay, so the Chaldeans would be the more wicked ones, and when God answers them the first time, he says, I'm going to bring the Chaldeans to judge, right? Now, why was that problematic for Habakkuk? His first complaint, the conversation goes, he's crying out because of what? The idolatry, but also the...
He wasn't getting an answer. There was silence on, mm-hmm. on the Lord's side for some time, it seems.
Right.
Exactly,
yeah. He didn't hear anything back from the Lord. Okay, so there was idolatry, there was injustice, right? People were oppressing other people, and so the cries of the suffering are going out, and nothing is happening. So it wasn't just the idolatry that God was allowing to continue, it was also the oppression that was happening within the Promised Land amongst God's people. And Habakkuk, first of all, cries out, why are you not doing anything about this, Lord God? Okay, so then God's first answer is what again? I am doing something, and what is he going to do to deal with that idolatry and injustice that's happening in Israel?
He's going to chastise Israel with a nation more wicked than them.
Right. He says, I am going to do something. I'm bringing the Chaldeans to judge the nation. And that, we know, is the Babylonian captivity, where they wiped out the temple and took the people captive back to Babylon. Okay. So, now, once again, why was that a problem? Because he says, well, that doesn't really fix anything. You're going to judge us with people who are even more wicked than we are. You know, the Babylonians were notorious for taking over other lands. And yeah.
When the Babylonians took over here, was that when Esther's parents were taken to Babylon?
It could have been her ancestors were probably... we don't know exactly her lineage. She could have been... her ancestors might have been part of the northern kingdom, which went to Assyria, and then Babylon conquered Assyria, and they came back together. But somehow, yeah, her ancestors, she was Jewish, which means, yeah. In fact, they were referring to the people of Judea as the Jews, and so probably, yeah, her ancestors were from Judah. Yeah.
If it was so, like, if she was from there, like, when they took over right there, then we see how the Lord worked everything together for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And her story, of course, fits in because if the Jews in Judea were wiped out along with every other Jew in the provinces of Persia, then the Messiah couldn't have come from the Jewish people, right? Okay, so now when Habakkuk complains about the fact that this more wicked nation is going to be the ones to come in and judge the wickedness of Judah, what is the Lord's answer? Exactly, yeah. He says that they will also be judged. Okay, so can you see that the principle is that God judges wickedness, but it is a matter of time, right? And so that's why what do you find is the final basis for Habakkuk's continuing to have faith in God? What does he understand? The just shall live by faith. And what's the content of his faith? The word of the Lord, right? God had promised him that he will judge it, but he says, wait for it. It is for the appointed time. And so, based on that, at the end of the book, Habakkuk is praising God because he's so sure that his word is going to come to pass. And he, I'm sure, had been able to see God's judgment looking over the history of Israel, but he knows that God's word is going to hold true and that God does plan to deal with wickedness. He's not going to let it go on forever, even though you just have to wait for it. So he's left in a position of faith, resting on the Lord, trusting in his word that he will bring it to pass. So anything personally strike you, like in your own life situation, that you want to share? Like, you see the lesson in Habakkuk's life. How does it relate to yours? Yeah. Yeah, so you really can get a lot out of it as far as waiting on the Lord, right? And the temptation, I think, when waiting on the Lord is to distract yourself and just let the time pass by. But is that really the picture we get from the Bible? No, it's like, it's almost like waiting on a table. If you guys ever been a server at a restaurant, some of you probably have had jobs in that line of work. But you're attentive to the needs of the table that you're waiting on, right? And that's more what it's like, is you're there as a servant before your master, just ready for whatever God might speak to you. And so you're not distracted like you turn away from the Lord and just kind of do your own thing for a while and say, oh, God will make it happen eventually. No, you continually go to him and keep asking, turning your face toward God, opening your heart toward him, and that's what waiting on the Lord really looks like. And I think there's some great passages on that theme. Those that wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They will mount up with wings as eagles, right? They shall run and not be weary. And so that active waiting on the Lord, he gives you strength during that process as well. That's why Habakkuk can sing that beautiful song of praise at the end of the book. Because as he waits on the Lord gives him strength to do that. So faith is that way, isn't it? It's like you already have the promises. Like they're so real to you that you know they're going to happen that already you have the joy that would come from their fulfillment. Well, let's turn to chapter 6. And right now we're going to look at Job's response to Eliphaz. He's still very much in the middle of his trial, isn't he? There's been no relief from the sores. Everything he had is still gone. And the suffering is continuing for Job. But Eliphaz had come to him and finally broken his silence and responded to him. And what was a summary of the message Eliphaz brought to him? How would you summarize what Eliphaz said to Job? Yep. He says, here's what I would do, and what is it? You want to look back at it? We better get this right before we continue. So it's chapter 5, right? He does, first of all, emphasize that you reap what you sow. And then in chapter 5, verse 8, he says, somebody want to read that for us? Read out 5, verse 8, nice and loud.
But as for me, I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause.
Yep, as for me, I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause, who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. And then he goes all the way down, continuing on with that, and then he says, you shall know also that your offspring shall be many, and your descendants as the grass of the earth. You shall come to your grave in ripe old age like a sheaf gathered up in its season. So, behold, this we have searched out. It is true. Hear and know it for your good. So it's pretty heartless of him, isn't it, to say, look, just seek God, appease him, basically, and you're going to have all these children and descendants. And he says that at a point when Job has just lost all 10 of his children. He tells him that you're going to, you know, live a long time and go to your grave when the one thing Job wants is to have his life ended right now, right? He's promising him all these years when Job really wants instant death and peace. So he thinks he's saying the right thing, but he's misguided. He's falling into Satan's trap, appeasement theology. Basically, submit to God in order that, and here's the motive, in order that he'll restore all your blessings. And that is exactly what Satan accused Job of having as his motive. So Job replies to Eliphaz in chapter 6. And we have five chapters we're doing today, so you want to split this up into five different people who can come up and read it? Because you'll be listening to me enough anyway, as it is, so you guys want to shoulder some of the load here?
I'll read nine.
You'll read nine? Okay. That's a rough chapter. That's some of the strongest words Job uses talking to God. Do you want to do one?
Yeah, I'll do one.
Do chapter 6?
Okay.
Okay, anybody for chapter 7, words of Job? Doesn't have to be a guy. As we saw last week with Rachel, did a good job with it. Anybody for chapter 7? All right. Good. Sam, we're missing 8.
I'll do 8.
You'll do 8? Okay, Sarah. And then we just need a person for 10. You threw me off there. You going to do 10? Okay. You going to do it in that voice?
No.
All right. Your real voice? Very good. Okay, so here's what we'll do. We'll have, was it Corey? You're going to read chapter 6? Okay. You're going to do chapter 6. Who had 7? All right, so we'll do those two, and then we'll go through and do some comments on it, try to understand it, and then move on with the rest of them, okay? So come on up. Here, let me, we can leave this right here. It'll still pick up the sound. Okay, Job chapter 6. Follow along in your Bible.
Okay, oops. Just closed it. Then Job answered and said, "Oh, that my grief were fully weighed, and my calamity laid with it on the scales, for then it would have been heavier than the sands of the seas. Therefore, my words have been rash, for the arrows of the Almighty were within me. My spirit drinks in their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me. Does the wild donkey bray when it has grass, or does the oxen low over its fodder? Can flavorless food be eaten without salt, or is there any taste in the white of an egg? My soul refuses to touch them. Oh, are as loathsome food to me. Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant me the things that I long for, that it would please God to crush me, that he would lose his hand and cut me off. Then I would still have comfort, though I in anguish I would exult. He will not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. What strength do I have that I should hope? And what is the end that I should prolong my life? Is my strength the strength of stones, or is my flesh bronze? Is my help not within me? And is success driven from me? To him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friends, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. My brothers have dealt deceitfully like a brook, like the streams of the brook that pass away, which are dark because of ice and into which the snow vanishes. When it is warm, they cease to flow. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. The paths of their very way turn aside. They go nowhere and perish. The caravans of the the travelers of Sheba hope for them. They are disappointed because they were confident. They come there and are confused. For now you are nothing. You see terror and are afraid. Did I ever say, bring something to me, or offer the bribe for me for your wealth, or deliver me from my enemy's hands, or redeem me from the hand of oppressor? Teach me, and I will hold my tongue. cause me to understand wherein I have erred. How forceful are your right words, but what does your anguish prove? Do you intend to rebuke my words, and in the speech of a desperate one, which are as wind? Yes, you overwhelm the fatherless, and you undermine your friend. Now, therefore, be pleased to look at me, for I would never lie to your face. Yield now, let there be no injustice. Yes, concede, my righteousness still stands. Is there injustice in my tongue? Cannot my taste discern the unsavory?
Is there not a time of hard service for man on earth? Are not his days also like the days of a hired man? Like a servant who earnestly desires a shade, and like a hired man who eagerly looks for his wages. So I have been allotted months of futility, and wearisome nights have been appointed to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise, and the night be ended? For I have had my fill of tossing till dawn. My flesh is caked with worms and dust. My skin is cracked and breaks out afresh. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. Oh, remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never again see good. The eye of him who sees me will see me no more. While your eyes are upon me, I shall no longer be. As the clouds disappear and vanishes away, so he goes down to the grave, does not come up. He shall never return to his house, nor shall his place know him any more. Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I a sea or a sea serpent that you set a guard over me? When I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that my soul chooses strangling and death rather than my body. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are but a breath. What is man that you should exalt him, that you should set your heart on him, that you should visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow my saliva? Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust, and you will seek me diligently, but I will no longer be.
All right, thank you. So, does Job agree with Eliphaz? Not at all, right? What does he take issue with? What did you find anything in particular that he points out where Eliphaz is wrong? Does he argue against his logic or his philosophy?
Yeah, verse 8.
All right, verse 8 of chapter 6 or chapter 7.
He's wanting to die in chapter 6. Maybe that's what I was looking at.
Yeah. All right.
22 and 23 of chapter 6.
Okay. Yeah, Right. He denies doing that. Eliphaz hasn't yet accused him of any specific wrongdoing, right? But he really complains against Eliphaz's attitude, that Eliphaz is criticizing him for complaining and for crying out his vexation and things like that. So before we get into it, though, let's notice that the drama is now heightening, right? There's argument going back and forth. Eliphaz has weighed in, and Job is going to come back and respond to that. So now I think what's happening is it's going beyond a matter of the loss of his possessions, the grief over that loss, the loss of his health, and just the physical pain there. I think now the psychological and spiritual battle is raging here. You know, it's a battle in his mind, and sometimes that's the worst suffering of all, right? Is that he just can't make sense of it. He can't see any reason for it. They're offering explanations, and they're more frustrating than anything. So the friends have been taken into the service of Satan here, haven't they? Can you see? And try to look for that as we listen to the friends talk. What is it about their advice that fits in with what Satan really wants to happen? They mean well, but they're adding to Job's frustration with God, and that might lead him to curse God and forget God altogether, or to try to appease God and therefore reveal that his motives all along have just been to serve God, and that's what he really wants, serve God in order to be blessed. So Job explains and defends his complaints in verses 1 to 13. He answers Eliphaz's accusation. Again, he doesn't argue against his logic or philosophy in general. He doesn't say, your whole way of looking at the world is wrong. He just really has a problem with his critical attitude toward Job's complaints. In verses 1 to 4, he explains the reason for his complaining. He tries to justify the way he's crying out in light of his suffering. One thing that's important to notice is that chapter 5, verse 2, Eliphaz had shared this proverb that says, vexation kills the fool. Vexation kills the fool. And then here in chapter 6, verse 2, Job says, oh, that my vexation were weighed, and all my calamity laid in the balances. Okay, so the meaning of the term vexation is this grieved complaint. Okay, it means angry passions or indignations, grounds for resentment caused by grief. And so Eliphaz says that this type of vexation that Job is doing is going to kill the fool. And so you see how he's lining Job up with the fool, like he's stupid and foolish, immoral even, because foolish always carries moral implications in the Old Testament, that he's foolish to be vexing himself against God like this. But Job says that his indignation, his vexation, should be tested to see if it really is justifiable. And he's basically saying, look at my circumstances here. You know, I wasn't unrighteous, and yet this has happened to me. So therefore, my vexation is justified. Let it be weighed in the balances. He says that Eliphaz could not sympathize with his lament, his vexation, because he did not understand the heaviness of his affliction. See in verse 3 there of chapter 6, for then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. In other words, if you test the vexation that I have right now, and you weighed it out, you would find out it is heavier than the sand of the sea. Have you guys ever lifted sandbags? Just a small one, it feels like a ton, right? Wet sand is incredibly heavy, and so it's a perfect metaphor for Job to use as far as the grief that he's going through. He feels pierced with poisoned arrows from God. Can you pick up on that? He feels like God has made him his target, and he has shot poison arrows into Job. That's pretty vivid as well. And notice that he's looking at God as the one who's totally sovereign and responsible for what has happened to him. In verses 5 to 7, Job defends his complaining with illustrations from everyday life. So listen to these. He says, first of all, that animals do not complain without reason, and neither does he. Here's some wild donkeys braying and fighting in the wilderness. what he seems to be saying also is that deep suffering, a truly grieving circumstance, and emotional cries like the ones he's been giving toward God go together like salt and bland food. And depending on your translation, you may have the tastelessness of the white of an egg or the juice of the mallow. It's really unclear as far as what he's actually referring to, but you can see the main point is that it's bland food. Bland food requires salt, just like heavy grief requires a lament. So what Job is saying is that heavy affliction calls for strong wailing. Therefore, Job's complaints are appropriate in this situation and justified in light of his situation. So he has a stronger sense of what he's going through, obviously, than the friends do. In verses 8 to 13, Job begs for death, defends his integrity, and asks Eliphaz to understand that he is merely a helpless human being, not some superman with this great ability to cope with what's happened to him. He doesn't have any great hope. He's not a man of exceptional patience, strength, and self-sufficiency. So he feels like Eliphaz is expecting him to be much stronger than he really is. What's interesting is that Job is all those things in the final summation of his story, right? He does come out, you know, even in the book of James, he's held up as an example of patient endurance or steadfastness. Verses 14 to 30, moving right along, he reproaches his friends. So here's where Job turns back and really criticizes the friends already represented by Eliphaz for the way that they're responding to him. In verse 14, Job had not abandoned his fear of the Almighty, but even if he had, he would need companionship. And that's an interesting thing for him to say, isn't it? He said, I have not turned away from God, but even if I had, I would still need true friendship. That's instructive, isn't it? That a person who has lost their faith in God or has turned away from him, maybe just for a time in light of something they're going through, they still feel the need for companionship. Do you guys have any family members who are in that situation where maybe you have a family member who has lost their faith, but they still obviously value your friendship and your love as their brother or sister? That's what I've gone through with my brother, actually. He had that where he basically lost his fear of the Almighty and came to a point where he couldn't worship the God of Christianity anymore as he saw him because of a painful situation that he went through in his life where he was disappointed with God. But yet, like maybe even more than ever, he still wants the companionship of his family, just like Job did. So there's something to that, and you don't want to affirm the person's unbelief in any way, right? But how are they going to really, have a good example of a person who is walking with God that might, help them turn back to God one day if everyone abandons them? And so it's not the same as a person continuing in deliberate sin or something like that and claiming to be a Christian all the while. It's a person who just don't believe in God, and they still need someone there to be a witness to them. I think that's very interesting that Job would say that. Even if he had abandoned his fear of the Almighty, he would still need companionship. In verses 15 to 23, Job states his disappointment with his friends. Job's friends were like a river which is full of ice in the winter, but dries up in the summer when it is most needed, right? All the water's there in the winter when it's cool, but then in the summer when it's hot and everyone requires more water, it just dries up and evaporates. That's how he sees his friends. They had all the wisdom in the world when everything was going fine, but now that he needs them the most, they've disappointed him. He goes further with another metaphor, similar to the first one. He likens them to watercourses or streams that go off into the desert. These streams are desperately followed by merchants and caravans that are following the watercourse for their journey. But when they follow it out into the desert, they're led to their death because they find out that the stream just, again, ends up nowhere. And there they are stranded with no water in the middle of the desert. So Job expected to be refreshed by his friends, but he was devastated and disappointed as they only made his misery worse. So is Job right about Eliphaz's counsel and where it leads? He is, right? He senses that this is not leading him to life, it's leading him to death. It further discourages him. And we know that because of the prologue, whereas Job isn't aware that the whole test was about his motive for worshiping God and fearing God, but we do. And so we can see how Eliphaz's advice fits in with that. Serve God, submit to him in order to get blessed. There's quite a few passages in the New Testament that talks about messengers who refresh. There's several times in Paul's letters where he talks about, so-and-so has refreshed me in the Lord, or I'm sending so-and-so to you so that they will refresh you. And so a good messenger refreshes the person that they're taking the message to. But Job's friends are the opposite. In fact, a quick mention of the theme or the motto for the conference center here is refreshing the saints. That's, Philippians 1:21 or Philemon 1:21?
Philemon 7.
7? Okay, never mind. Getting my references all mixed up. Philemon 7. So that's an important aspect of our ministry to one another is refreshing each other. And that's where Job's friends let him down. So Job suspects that his friends were afraid to sympathize with him too deeply, fearing they might fall under God's judgment. All right, do you understand what this means? They're afraid of really identifying with him because why? They believe that he's under God's judgment for something he's done wrong. So they don't want to be Job's friends necessarily because that might align them with the wicked, whom they believe Job is. Have you ever known anyone like that who condemns you, they're saying you're going through what you're going through because you've sinned, and they say, I'm not stooping to your level, right? Because I don't want to be like a wicked person, the kind of person God judges. But he continues on. He says he's never asked for anything from his friends. He's never asking for money from them or anything like that. Even now, he only desired their companionship, and they refused to give it. Then in verse 24, Job asks his friends to show him evidence of what he did wrong. And this is where he really pinpoints what's lacking. He says, "Teach me, and I will be silent. Make me understand how I have gone astray." So he's asking them to demonstrate what it is that he's done wrong. If he deserves the suffering, what is it that he did that has led to this? And, of course, they really can't come up with anything. Later on, they begin to fabricate some things, but he's able to deny them all. In verses 25 to 26, Job says he could benefit from honest words even if they hurt, but his friend's advice ignorantly discarded the facts. First of all, Job had a clear conscience. That's fact number one. In fact, number two, he personally had a clear conscience, but he also was giving a testimony of his innocence. So he had his conscience, that's the internal subjective evidence, and then the witness that he's giving about that as well. So those are the facts that they can't seem to disprove. Verse 27, Job felt like his friends were taking him captive, self-righteously selling him off for personal gain. A modern expression would be throwing him under the bus to make themselves feel better. Can you see how this works? A self-righteous person sees their neighbor's hardship as a seal to their own moral excellence. Why? Because if you're suffering because you did something wrong, or there was something wrong with you, or you needed to learn something, and I'm not suffering, then I must be better than you, right? So that's one more reason why they can't be a true friend to Job, because they're thinking, this judgment has not come upon me, so I must be more righteous than him or her. So that seems to be their position. And it makes sense in light of their theology or philosophy, right? If God always makes the wicked suffer, and if he always rewards the righteous, then if I find myself rewarded or just fine, then I must be more righteous than the person who suffers. Yeah. I believe it is. Yeah. It's self-righteousness would be the assumption that I am righteous in myself, right? Instead of just humbly depending on God's righteousness on my behalf. Very good. Verse 28, listen to what Job says. He asked his friends to look at him as he spoke. Perhaps they were finding it difficult to look on his disfigured face. Remember, they had a hard time even recognizing him when they first approached. So the boils and everything like that, he describes later on as everything is just breaking apart. His skin is dry and cracked, and he's completely disfigured. And so they might find it very difficult to even look at a person like Job in that situation. But he's appealing to them that they would really face the reality of what he's going through. They're criticizing him for crying out to God and complaining, and they're saying that this is because he suffered or he was unrighteous in some way. But just to look at Job's face, imagine that, into his eyes, a man who's lost all of his family members except for his wife, and all of his possessions, everything that defined him in worldly terms, and now his health as well. I mean, if you really look at a person and observe impartially, could you really say that he must have done some huge sin to deserve that? And that's what he's appealing to, is like, really, guys, do you seriously believe that? This is punishment for some sin. Must have been the greatest sin ever committed, and yet everybody, nobody had a realistic complaint against Job's character. In verse 29, Job passionately calls his friends back to the main issue. The main issue is his righteousness. Can they produce any evidence that he was wicked? On into chapter 7. Chapter 7, verses 1 to 21, is now Job complaining to God again. So he's answered Eliphaz. I think, would you agree that he's had a sufficient answer to Eliphaz? He asks for evidence, and he asks for a reality check. But he starts with the Lord by describing the misery of human life in verses 1 to 10. Verses 1 to 5 of chapter 7 describe the hard conditions of life, how it's toilsome. His illness probably included horrible dreams. These often accompany really bad illnesses. So remember, Satan could do basically anything to Job except for take away his life, except for kill him, right? And it's only an act of mercy if one day he is restored. But We know that dreams are a way definitely that can be, can definitely be satanic, and a way that a person can be afflicted, because you wake up after a dream like that and you don't feel rested at all, do you? I think a lot of people have experienced that here at Bible College, having really threatening and evil dreams and things like that, and it's definitely an aspect of spiritual warfare that we need to be fighting against. But it probably included that. He alludes to it here in this chapter. In verses 6 to 10, Job describes the brief duration of life. He says it's so fast, but yet why is the suffering so great? He refers to Sheol, which really just means the grave or death in this context. And he sees Sheol as the place of no return. In other words, people, when they go to Sheol or the grave, they never come back again. That's what he observes. Verses 11 to 21, Job appeals to God for relief. In verse 11, he states his decision to speak to God, so he's resolved that he's taking this directly to God. He's not just going to talk to his friends about it. He's taking it directly to God. And in verses 12 to 21, we find Job's threefold appeal. First of all, he says, I am harmless. This is part of his appeal. I am harmless. I am insignificant, second. And then third, what is man that you're mindful of him? And it's interesting here again in Job how we have a contrast of ideas with other parts of the Bible. Like, you probably remember that phrase from a different place, and it's Psalm 144 is one spot. I think it's in there a few times. Psalm 144, 1 through 8. This is actually Psalm 144, 1 through 8 is similar to Job's complaint. It says things like, O Lord, what is man that you regard him, or the son of man that you think of him? Man is like a breath, his days are like a passing shadow. So there's parts of it that are the same, but the psalmist really sees it a blessing that God would think of man. Whereas Job is like, why do you take the trouble to afflict me like this? So you see, it's just like the hedge of God, right? He sees God after his trial as like hedging him in and oppressing him, whereas the hedge was more like a protecting hedge in a different situation, right? So that's just how our human perspectives on life work. Depending on our perspective, we see God differently. And so we got to try to think beyond our limited perspective when we think of God. He asks God, have I sinned? Then why don't you forgive me if I'm going to die anyway? He believed that he wasn't going to live through this, and so he wonders why God doesn't just pardon him of his sin if he has committed it, because he's going through so much suffering. Why could God not let him simply die with some peace and comfort? Why afflict him all the way to the grave? Okay, so let's evaluate and summarize. To Eliphaz and the friends, he says, my complaint is justified. You've crushed my spirit. You have no evidence for your claim that I am guilty. That's how he responds. He justifies his complaint. He says that they are discouraging him. They're bad friends in that sense because of their critical attitude. And they further have no evidence that he actually is guilty. It's important to see those three elements in his speech. This is a picture of the desert around where Job probably lived. You can imagine this dry stream bed right here in the middle? Does that show up at all? Yeah, so that's what he sees his friends like. You can see where the water once was, but it's disappointed him. To God, Job says, my condition is miserable, meaningless, and hopeless. I direct my complaint to you. And he just wonders why. Why doesn't God give him some peace before he dies? Now, another aspect that we haven't really talked about with what Job's going through is the aspect of finances. Because remember, all of his livestock and things like that were the way that he would feed himself and his wife now, right? But they're all gone. So he does have that added problem, right? How is he going to survive financially, you could say? And so would it not make sense for his friends to bring some kind of practical help to help support him? But we don't find them bringing anything. At the end of the book, you find his friends and family bringing things to help him, to restore him. But the friends, although they did bring their presence, just themselves being there for 7 days, that was good, but they didn't offer any kind of practical help. So you can see how that was a need for Job in the situation too. So what do you think the key is to being an effective friend and counselor? What have you noticed so far? What's the key to be an effective friend and counselor for people who go through things like this?
Compassionate.
What's that? Yeah, heaping blame on a person is very damaging to them, isn't it?
Practice listening.
Listening, that's right.
Believe them,
yeah. Give them the benefit of the doubt, right? Take their word for it. Unless you have some evidence that's like, and even then you don't necessarily, that's not maybe the time to share that with them. But yeah, believe them, that's key. I like that, good.
Just be there for them and practically as well.
Yep, be there. Give them the gift of your presence. That's with a C-E on the end, not T-S. Presence, not presence. Unless the presence are of some practical nature, that does help. Yeah.
Bear one another's burdens.
Amen. Bear one another's burdens. That's Galatians 6:2. But it really all boils down to unselfishness, right? That if you're really going to be a good friend, a good counselor, you have to be unselfish. You have to give of yourself to take on somebody else's burden. And I think that's the problem with people who want to give this wise advice like Job's friends, is it's really pride, not unselfishness. It's selfishness, not unselfishness, that motivates them, because they want to be the wise counselor. They want to be seen as the person with all the answers. And I think a lot of people can fall into that when they want to be a counselor in general, you know, that there's a lot of pride there. Because, people come to me for, you know, with all their problems, and I get to be the sage that assuages all their fears and tells them all the right things about God. You know, there's a lot of pride that can be wrapped up in that. But if you really want to be an effective counselor, then you'd be like Jesus, who emptied himself for our sake, right? He lowered himself and stepped down, and that is the model for really being an effective friend and a wonderful counselor like Jesus, is that he was completely unselfish in how he went about it. He sacrificed for the sake of others. And that's exactly right. Like Dewey said, Galatians 6:2, we are to bear one another's burdens. And really, you know, sometimes it's obvious that it cuts against our pride and selfishness because it involves a big sacrifice. So if Job was experiencing God's punishment, it would make sense for God to back off and give Job a break before he died, right? He'd be merciful to do that. But Job thought he was ready for death. However, God had plans to bless Job in the end. Yeah?
At the very end of chapter 7, he actually says, "Why do you not pardon my transgression and forgive my iniquity?" Why did he just agree with his friends all of a sudden? I'm confused as to why he even brought that up. If he knows he's blameless, why would he even go as far as to acknowledge that? Like, just to even make that statement. It seems like he kind of bends over it just a little bit. Just wavers just a little bit there.
Yeah, he does say, if I had sinned, right? If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? Why have you made me your mark? Why have I become a burden to you? Why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth. You will seek me, but I shall not be. So, yeah, do you guys think he's acquiescing to the friend's advice in any way there? No? Yeah, it's hypothetical. He's not saying he did sin. He's just, he's kind of acknowledging that if that was, he's, I think, using it to prove that it's not the case by saying that if it was, then this would make sense. But that's not the case, so it even contradicts their view even more. Here's a quote from John Calvin. I think it's from the 1560s. He wrote a bunch of sermons on Job. He has like a huge book. I forget how many. I think it was like 200 sermons on Job. He says that if we look no further than our present circumstances, we will be dismayed. So can you see how that's the case? If you're in a situation like we talked about, from your vantage point, from the middle of that trial, things look bad. And if that's all you have to look at, then it's gonna be dismaying for sure. There's an atheistic philosopher named Bertrand Russell. He's gone now. But he said, no one can sit at the bedside of a dying child and believe there is a God. Okay, so there again, if the only evidence for God that you consider is this dying child that you're sitting next to, the case for God doesn't look really convincing, right? But there again, you know, that would be a huge challenge to your faith, but We have to somehow get outside, and that's why at the end of Job, I think he has him consider creation to get the big picture on the universe. Yeah. The first quote, if we look no further than our present circumstances, we will be dismayed.
What does that dismayed mean?
Dismayed? Yeah. Discouraged? Yeah. Yeah, discouraged would probably be the nearest synonym. And so we have to consider all the evidence. And again, that's why creation is so important, because when you just let it sink in that this is real, this had to come from somewhere, you know, it eventually leads, you can doubt everything, but you can't doubt that you exist, right? You have to believe, at least I'm alive to doubt, and so where did I come from? And I think the most reasonable explanation always has to be that there is a God, and if there is a God, then that reorients your perspective. There are some pieces of evidence, if taken on their own, like Job's trial, like a dying child, that if that's all you have, then it is very hard to believe and trust in God. That's why there's so much more to consider, and especially for us, you know, we have God on the cross demonstrating his love for us while we were still sinners. So, you know, we have more to work with than Job did, but he did have creation, and that's what God ends up bringing him back to. So it helps to look at the past, to see what God has done in the past, and creation is part of that, although he's still a creator God, and he's sustaining his creation. And we also look forward to the future as well. And Job seems to be able to do both these things. He knows he walked with God faithfully in the past, and he knows that he has hope for the future. At least it flashes in at some points, and he doesn't lose it completely. Okay, so that's Job 6 and 7. Then next, Bildad will speak. But before we do that, let's take a 10-minute break.
That's tough work. It's good work. That's the best apologetic testimony, whatever, of all. Yeah, I mean, so many times Paul was appealing to the fact that he was genuine, you know? Yeah. So that, to validate the message, you know, that's important. It's very important.
Daniel, do you want to call the others in? Reading chapter 8. Anybody remember? That's right. Sarah. Sarah, a.k.a. Bildad. Sarah's going to be Bildad. Okay, so. All right, yeah, so you're just doing chapter 8.
Okay. Good, you can leave. Bye.
All right, turn to chapter 8, everybody. Chapter 8.
Should we start? Okay. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, "How long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a great wind? Does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert the right? If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. And though your beginning was small, your latter days will be very great. For inquire, please, of bygone ages, and consider what the fathers have searched out. For we are but of yesterday and know nothing, for our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and utter words out of their understanding? Can papyrus grow where there is no marsh? Can reeds flourish where there is no water? While yet in flower and not cut down, they wither before any other plant. Such are the paths of all who forget God. The hope of the godless shall perish. His confidence is severed, and his trust is a spider's web. He leans against his own house, but it does not stand. He lays hold of it, but it does not endure. He is a lush plant before the sun, and his shoots spread over his garden. His roots entwine the stone heap. He looks upon a house of stones. If he is destroyed from his place, then it will deny him, saying, I have never seen you. Behold, this is the joy of his way, and out of the soil others will spring. Behold, God will not reject a blameless man, nor take the hand of evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more.
Okay, so how would you summarize Bildad's contribution here? What are the big ideas he's bringing across? You've heard it three times at least now. You got to be asking questions of the Bible when you're reading it, you know? What are you looking for? What is he saying? What's his big message? POR, somebody said? Yes. Can you see the appeasement theology at work in there? And, of course, it's all within the framework of the principle of what? Retribution, right? That's his framework. And remember the triangle? Actually, you know what? Let me just look up the slide real quick. This might be easier. There it is. Okay, so remember how we said Job? His main emphasis is on his righteousness. The friend's main emphasis is on the retribution principle. But their counsel to Job, their advice to Job is appeasement, right? Appease in order to get blessed. And then they also are concerned with God's justice. They're angry that Job is, you know, implying that God might be unjust here or that his government of the world is unjust. But their frame of reference is the principle of retribution because that's the accepted wisdom of the day. And then Elihu comes in later. And his emphasis is on God's justice. Okay, so let's take a closer look at Bildad's speech and see what else he has to say here. All right. So he emphasizes the greatness of God. His tone is a little different than Eliphaz, right? Eliphaz was dignified, he was self-restrained in what he said. But Bildad directly implies that Job's children died because they sinned. Note the words these guys choose here. They're talking about his children, but Bildad especially, he talks about a great wind, and then in the very next part of the verse, or in the very next verse, he says, if your children sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. Wasn't it a great wind that knocked the roof down on top of the children and crushed them to death, all 10 of them? So is Bildad the most insensitive person in the world? Is he stupid or is he implying it on purpose? What do you think? Is it deliberate or is he just ignorantly using the most horrible words possible? You think it's on purpose? Yeah. If he really believes that the principle of retribution is a true description of the way God governs the world, then he would have to conclude that it was because they sinned that the wind knocked the roof on top of them, right? So you can see how painful it would be for Job to even hear that, and how angry that might make him, right? Would it make you angry if somebody said that it was because your children were, you know, were wicked that it happened? Job was even concerned about some secret sin in their hearts, and that's why he was concerned to make the sacrifices for them, right? So he wasn't ignorant to their sins, but, you know, he doesn't believe that can adequately explain it, for sure. So he starts by saying God is great and he's never unjust. He takes God's justice for granted, obvious. So Bildad's really repudiating Job's words in 6 verse 26. So he's answering back, just like Job answered Eliphaz on the issue of the vexation, Job had said in 6:26, do you think that you can reprove words when the speech of a despairing man is wind? And so then Bildad comes in and says, and the words of your mouth be a great wind. Okay, so you can see he's confronting Job and picking up on what he had said. In verse 4, Bildad takes for granted that Job's children sinned, and that was the reason they were killed. And again, we can think of how hurtful that must have been. Verses 5 to 7, Bildad says that if Job appeals to God from a pure heart, so in other words, if he What does he say in verses 5 and forward? If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, then surely he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. Total appeasement theology, right? Just plead with God for mercy so that he blesses you. And of course, live right before God so that it leads to God's blessing you. That's totally the self-interested motive, right? So he believes that God is held by the law of retribution as if it were a straitjacket. This is always the way God must act in governing his world. But we've got to remember, there's no principle or law that can be put above God that would define how God always must act. He can have purposes beyond our attempts at defining his activity. So in 8 through 19, the wicked are always punished, is his emphasis there. First of all, in verses 8 to 10, Bildad decides that the wisdom of the fathers is more valuable than what he or Job could say. So he appeals to the wisdom of people who had gone before, right? And so he brings some of that across. He defers to the wisdom of the fathers, saying in verses 11 to 15, it is useless for Job to depend on his innocence. It is like leaning on a spider's web. Here's a picture of a spider's web. You can imagine leaning on that, right? Putting your confidence in that, you would fall, right? Obviously, it wouldn't work. So he's saying that's for Job to depend on his own innocence in this whole scenario is foolish. It's like leaning on a spider's web. And then the other message he's bringing across is that the fate of all who forget God is like that of reeds without water or papyrus without water. So here's papyrus plants. We actually have those in our very own oasis garden over here in the center of campus. Have you ever seen the papyrus there? If anybody runs out of paper, you could get some of those and be like the Egyptians. You roll them out, pound them together, and make yourself some paper, just like they did 3,000-4,000 years ago. So, but the point is, like, you can see these plants grow where there's plenty of water. The fate of a person who forgets God is the same as those plants would be if they were taken away from that water source. They would die. Verses 16 to 19, having a materially prosperous life is ultimately meaningless. It is like a lush plant that is one day uprooted and forgotten. So he's kind of saying you're better off without your possessions, right? That's what he seems to be saying. Maybe. Although he still at the same time encourages Job to get right with God or to do what's right and seek mercy from God in order that he would get his possessions restored. So he's kind of contradicting himself, as they do very often. And then he really clearly brings across the principle of retribution in verse 20. God does not cast away the blameless, and he will not support evildoers. So he kind of puts it in the negative. He will not cast away the blameless, and he will not support evildoers. But it's funny because blameless was the very word that God himself used to describe Job in the prologue. So he's guaranteeing, if that was the case, that you know Job shouldn't be cast off in this current circumstance, but he is. He tries to give Job hope for the future in verses 21 to 22. He says, earnestly seek God and ask the Almighty for mercy. Bildad says that Job will be given laughter and joy, and his enemies will perish. And like Eliphaz, he is pushing Job to appease God in order to get blessed. If Job follows his advice, he will prove Satan right. Now, do you have a clear sense? Do you take seriously how tempting that appeasement theology would be? You're going through something, and if you are convinced that all you need to do is just, you know, seek God and, you know, try to make God happy so that you'll get all your stuff back. Can you see how that would be a temptation if you bought into that? But the one thing that helps Job know that's not the way to go is because he knows he hadn't sinned ahead of time, and that's not the way the universe works. Yeah.
Because he's encouraging him to do it and getting his hopes up, and he's like, well, don't do it then.
Right.
Why do it if you think you haven't sinned and you continue thinking mm-hmm. this, then don't do it and you're not going to get here.
Yeah, exactly. So here's a question for you to think about, and I think it's one we can't ignore. If God did execute the principle of retribution in his universe at every moment on each person, would there be any or what would happen, I guess? We would either be dead, but really, I mean, even before that, there would never be any humans, right? Because in such a universe, you can't have a place for any meaningful human person to exist that makes actual real decisions, right? Because if everything is worked out that way, where it's, you know, bad action, you know, immediate, then it eliminates all real decision making. So another thing you lose is all the virtues, like patience, for example. There's no need of endurance if justice is always immediately given out, right? The whole point of endurance and patience is that you have to wait for things to be made right while you trust God. And that's exactly what James 5, 7, and 11, where Job is mentioned. That's what it brings across. Let me read that passage here. James chapter 5. Verse 7, first of all, be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. And it's ultimately the coming of Jesus that will finally deal out justice, right? That's the day of the Lord when judgment is actually brought fully. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it, until it receives the early and late rains. And it says, you also be patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. The judge is standing at the door. So it's the imminence of the return of Christ. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. So all of that means nothing if the principle of retribution is the way the world is always working. So our patience as God brings us through trials and endurance and faith as we wait for Jesus' return are pleasing to God and necessary for our maturity. That's it's the virtues and character that God wants to work in us, and you know, this prolonged waiting time really is what works that in us. Listen to Hebrews 12, verses 1 to 2. Therefore, since we also have such a large cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily ensnares us, and run with endurance the race that lies before us, keeping our eyes on Jesus, the source and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured a cross and despised the shame and sat down at the right hand of God's throne, or the majesty on high. So patience would be the capacity to accept delay or trouble or suffering without getting angry. Endurance, the fact or power of tolerating a difficult process without giving way. And steadfastness would be resolutely firm and unwavering. So there's three different words that kind of have the same picture of what we're called to do. And Jesus exemplified all those virtues, right? He endured the cross for us, and he did not rest until the work was done. Okay, so that's Bildad chapter 8, appeasement theology, principle of retribution, and he's fitting right in with Satan's trial of Job. Okay, was it Ramsey for chapter 9?
Is that microphone fine? There? Super. All right. My sight sucks, but... No, it's not. Then Job answered and said, truly, I know it is so, but how can a man be righteous before God? If one wished to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of 1,000. God is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and prospered? He removes the mountains, and they do not know, when he overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth out of his place, and its pillars tremble. He commands the sun, and it does not rise. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens and treads out the waves of the sea. He made the Bear, Orion, and Pleiades? How do you pronounce that? Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. He does great things past finding out. Yes, wonders without number. He goes by me, I do not see him. If he moves past, I do not perceive him. He takes away, who can hinder him? Who can say to him, what are you doing? God will not withdraw his anger. The allies of the proud lie prostrate beneath him. How then can I answer him and choose my words to reason with him? For though I were righteous, I could not answer him. I would beg mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with the tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not allow me to catch my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a matter of strength, indeed he is strong. And if of justice, who will appoint my day in court? Though I were righteous, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I were blameless, it would prove me perverse. I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life. Is it all one thing? Therefore I say, he destroys the blameless and the wicked. If the scourge slays suddenly, he laughs at the plight of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers out the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who else could it be? Now my days are swifter than a runner. They flee away. They see no good. They pass by like a swift ship. Shipped. Yes. Like an eagle swooping on a prey. If I say I will forget my complaint, I will put off my sad face and wear a smile. I am afraid of all my sufferings. I know that you will not hold me innocent. If I am condemned, why then do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow water and cleanse my hands with soap, yet you will plunge me into a pit, and my own clothes will abhor me. For he is not man as I am, that I may answer him, and that we should go to court together. Nor is there any mediator between us who may lay his hand on us both. Let him take his rod away from me, and do not dread of me terrify me. Of him terrify me. Then I would speak and not fear him, but it is not so with me.
My soul loathes my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. Does it seem good to you that you should oppress, that you should despise the work of your hands, and smile on the counsel of the wicked? Do you have eyes of flesh, or do you see as man sees? Are your days like the days of a mortal man? Are your years like the days of a mighty man, that you should seek for my iniquity and search out my sin? Although you know that I am not wicked, and there is no one who can deliver from your hand. Your hands have made me and fashioned me, an intricate unity, yet you would destroy me. Remember, I pray that you have made me like clay. And will you turn me into dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese, clothe me with skin and flesh, and knit me together with bones and sinews? You have granted me life and favor, and your care has preserved my spirit. And these things you have hidden in your heart. I know that this was with you. If I sin, then you mark me and will not acquit me of my iniquity. If I am wicked, woe to me. If I am righteous, I cannot lift up my head. I am full of disgrace. See my misery. If my head is exalted, you hunt me like a fierce lion, and again you show me yourself awesome against me. You renew your witnesses against me and increase your indignation toward me. Changes in war are ever with me. Why then have you brought me out of the womb? Oh, that I perished and no eye had seen me. I would have been as though I had not been. I would have been carried from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? Cease, leave me alone, that I may take a little comfort. Before I go to the place from which I shall not return, to the land of darkness and the shadow of death, a land as dark as darkness itself, as the shadow of death without any order, where even the light is like darkness.
So again, he replies to Bildad, and then he takes his prayer to God. So there are so many things we can pick up on here that we can't possibly comment on each one of them. I think that, you know, as you hopefully throughout your life go back to Job over and over again, that there will be times in your life where certain parts or certain verses really you identify with more at some times. And like he meditates on how God formed him. You know, he goes, like, pictures it as being poured out like milk and how you can turn milk into cheese, right? And then he covers him with skin and puts them all together like that, the process of creating a human being. And he's aware of all the things that went into making him up as a person, as a living human being. And now he feels like all that work of creation is just purposeless because God is attacking him and filling him with arrows and all those things. So there'll be times where, you know, depending, I hope not, but, you know, if God has some reason for allowing it, you know, you'll go through things like that. And but maybe even if you don't have the negative side of it, you could have those moments where you're aware of, like, all the billions, or is it trillions of cells in your body, you know, that individually work together to make up who you are as a person who's able to walk with God and to love God and love other people. It's amazing, isn't it? I was just, before we came up to class today, I sat down for a second to get some sunshine, and I looked down. I couldn't stay there very long because there was ants all over the ground, and they were climbing up onto me. So I didn't want to be, you know, crawling with ants all during class, so I had to move. But think about, like, that tiny creature, and it also is made up of millions of little, or billions, I don't even know, quadrillions of tiny little cells. And, you know, it's glorifying God, and it appears in Scripture as a demonstration of a good work ethic, you know, storing up things ahead of time, being a diligent worker. So creation just blows your mind when you really let it sink in, right? And you can see why it's so hard for Job to think, you know, why all this work of creation, especially in me, a person, and it seems to be purposeless, only for the sake of destroying me. Yeah. Yeah, Job, that's part of the story, is that we know something that Job has no idea, and that's partly what adds to the situation. I mean, you wonder how Job would have reacted if he would have known about the dialogue in heaven. See, because if he would have known that, he would have known the reason for why it happened, yeah. Right? And so the trial, it couldn't have taken place if Job knew. Does that make sense? But is Satan was the one who was given the ability to afflict Job, and it seems like he's also working, yeah, somehow through influencing the dialogue. He obviously had to influence the Sabians to come, you know, at least partly be working there as a contributing cause to them coming in and destroying what Job had as well, and the Chaldeans too. So yeah, I think Satan is still working, and although he's not mentioned as the adversary or the accuser anywhere else in the book, everything he stands for, you know, all the forces that are against God, I think we find that re-embodied in Leviathan at the end of the book. And so God basically brings across the assurance that even the worst, you know, you can imagine is still under God's sovereign control. So, good question. Yeah, he's still active, it seems like. All right, so in chapters 9 and 10, Job's main point is that he cannot force or compel God to vindicate him and declare him just. So in this section, this is the first time we really get to see the need for an advocate, someone else to kind of be a witness for Job, to lay his hand, to stand between Job and God, and to be an advocate for Job, right? Someone to bridge the gap. So he starts out, the first section, verses 1 through 24 of chapter 9, are really bringing across the point that mortals just cannot challenge God and expect to be vindicated by him. He starts out by agreeing with Bildad in verse 2. How can a person get a hearing before God? Verse 3. God is too big and powerful for anyone to be heard in his court. He won't go to court with me. I mean, it's not like I can say, you know, issue a summons to God and say, let's go to a court, let's have someone judge between us. Job seems to say, yes, Bildad, God is great and mighty, so great and mighty that we cannot approach him and be heard. We can't get a hearing against God. Bildad's message has added to Job's discouragement. And this is probably one of the lowest points in the book, chapter 9, as far as Job's feeling of despair. He's really pouring it out, and he really does call into question what in the world God is doing with the way he governs his universe. Verses 4 through 24, the Lord is unapproachably powerful. He describes the Lord as just and powerful, unapproachable. He pictures him acting in earthquakes, storms, eclipses, sky and sea, and in the stellar system, in the stars. So, you know, I want to ask a question here. It's often said that, okay, back in the old days, people would witness phenomena like weather, you know, the weather patterns, storms coming, earthquakes, and these great, you know, cataclysmic events, and they would say, that's God, that's God's hand doing that. All right, modern science has given us the ability to say, well, you know, when we watch the weather on the news, you know, it describes a cold front coming in and this and that, and we don't, if your weatherman said, God is moving this cloud, you know, this direction, and, you know, he's going to pour out some rain, he's going to throw down some rain over here, then you would question that description, right? But is it accurate to say that just because we have a scientific way of describing what happens, that we should no longer think of that as God acting, right? Because too often we say, it's a miracle if we don't have a scientific description of how it happened, right? But, so wouldn't that mean that back then it was a miracle when the weather happened, whereas today it's no longer a miracle? Do you see the problem? So just because you have a scientific explanation, does that mean you have to say, oh, God's not part of that? He stands back for only certain exceptions. You have to maintain a sense in which you see all of creation still as God here all the time, right? God is always there. And so, you know, you don't want to confuse people by saying things like we just talked about with the weatherman on the news, right? There's nothing wrong with, you know, describing it in scientific terms, but that doesn't mean that God is not carrying out his purposes in the world, right? So I think that whole view of God standing aloof, letting all the natural laws happen, and then just sometimes jumping in and fixing something is more of a deistic, almost, view. But what results is that the better science gets at explaining things, then God is more and more out of a job, right? And we don't want to buy into that way of thinking. So God is always there, whether we have a scientific description for it or not. And it could be that there, even though we don't know what they are, there could always be a scientific description of how God does certain things. But that doesn't mean it's not God. Okay, God is always there. He's the creator who is sustaining the world. And so there's a sense in which you can still say, look what God is doing. He's bringing the clouds in to give us rain, you know. And you can thank him for that. So to me, like, it's encouraging. You know, I don't have to be stuck. The more sophisticated science gets, the less I think about God's activity. There's no need for that. So that's how Job describes it, right? He describes these weather or, you know, the events on earth as acts of God. And it's not outdated, even today, to see things that way. He sees God as sovereign over everything, even weather. So also in the stellar system, in the stars. Now, in verse 8, there's also mention of God as trampling the waves of the sea. And does that remind you of anything else in the Bible later on? God walking on top of, trampling, stamping his authority over the waves of the sea. Jesus walking on water, right? And so it's important because when Jesus does walk on water and calm the storm, what does that reveal about who he is? Yeah, he's exercising his divine authority, right? So it's important that that's the prerogative of God, to be the master over weather as the creator. And so that's operating in Jesus when he walks on water. Although people in the ancient time, in Job's day, had limited knowledge of astronomy, they didn't have telescopes and space satellite photographs or anything like the Hubble telescope, but they were amazed that God made constellations in the sky. And they did study the stars closely, and perhaps more closely than the average one of us does, because for one thing, they didn't have city lights to distract them from it. Have you ever been out somewhere far away from a city, far away from pollution, on a really, like a moonless night, and you can really see the stars? Where I grew up in Mexico was way out in the mountains, and there was really no pollution yet at that point. And we had a hammock next to our porch that went over to our peach tree, And it sounds like a really nice place, but it really wasn't, okay? But there were some really good things, just like that. Like being able to look up and just see that hazy, you know, it looks like fog or something in the sky, but it's the Milky Way galaxy. And you realize that what looks like mist is actually billions and billions of stars. And that the stars that make up just our galaxy, that you can see that band out there, there's like billions more galaxies. And everything's spinning around at thousands of miles, millions of miles an hour. And yet here we are, and God is carrying out his purpose in the world. It's amazing. And so they contemplated those things more deeply than we often do. And there's a few constellations that are mentioned here. We've got here's some of the galaxies in Ursa Major. Ours is one of those. Or like one of those, I should say. And here's Orion, one of the ones that's mentioned. You can see Orion's belt. See these three stars right here in the middle? You can see those around here most of the year, and that's Orion's belt, so you can identify with the writer of Job 3,500 years ago, maybe more, 4,000 years ago. He was looking at the same stars that you are, and they were cause for him to contemplate the meaning of things. So it's pretty cool. We can look on the same thing. We even maintain the same names for it. So that's Orion. Also, the Pleiades are mentioned. They are gravitationally bound together. These always stay connected in the same way as far as the forces of gravity that keep them there where they are in relation to one another. They're also mentioned in Amos 5:8 and in Job 38, 31 to 32. So there are things you can learn from general revelation. General revelation, can anybody define what general revelation is as opposed to special revelation? Where? You're deferring to Brian?
General is just something like God saying basic commands, something like that. That's just like a general.
No, that would actually be part of special. When you find God directly speaking to individuals or anything in Scripture, that's part of special revelation. General revelation is something that is witnesses to every person, regardless of whether they believe the Bible or not. Yeah, it's and so what would be an example of general revelation?
Constellation,
yeah, creation itself. And like we said, we can go back, you can doubt that God exists, or you can doubt that there's really any purpose for the world, but when you doubt every single thing you can, like René Descartes, the philosopher from 1700s, he said, I can doubt everything, but you know, at the end of it all, I'm still alive to doubt. And that's a reality that I have to confront. And then you reason back forward, okay, where did I come from? What's the best explanation of my origin? And then, you know, if that's true, then what else might be true? And then you can get all the way back, you know, in terms of the best explanations, all the way back to faith in the God who personally reveals himself in Jesus Christ and who has a purpose. So he actually stole that from Augustine. He actually said that back in the 400s A.D., yeah. That would be special revelation because it's what God has done historically. You have events that happen, and God, through his Holy Spirit, inspires people to record those and the significance of those events as far as how they're developing in God's plan of redemption. Yeah. So general revelation has been there, you know, for everyone, for all time. And there's you can see how the thing that defines human beings is, you know, one of the things some people say is the fact of belief in God, you know. The religion has always been there in the very earliest civilizations. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, Romans 1 and 2 are exactly that, how God speaks through general revelation to all people. All right, so the next little section here, we have mention of Rahab, right? Did you see that? What verse was that in? 18? Oh, 13. Yes, God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him bowed the helpers of Rahab. And what is this thing? The word really means proud or arrogant, but it refers, if you look at the parallelisms in the rest of Scripture, to the fleeing serpent, and the fleeing sea monster, sea serpent. According to some sources in the Bible that indicate this and sources outside the Bible, this is the same beast that God overcame at creation. So it's parallel to Leviathan as well. It's another name symbolically, I think, that ties in with Satan as well as the adversary of God, the personal thing that stands against everything that God wants and opposes him, but, you know, is a perverse creation of God. In other words, God created it. It says in Psalm 104:26, you formed Leviathan to play in the sea, but yet it still stands against God's purposes and kind of embodies all the forces of destruction and evil in the world. So on this whole issue of Rahab, Leviathan, the dragon, write down these verses, okay? It's important to kind of get them all together, and just on your own, the things I said about this whole issue in the I think it was class number 2 maybe, might have seemed a little unbelievable. So check it out for yourself, and I think you'll find that it's pretty surprising. But Psalm 89, verses 8 through 11, Psalm 89, verses 8 through 11, and Isaiah 51, 9 to 10. That's where he says he cut Rahab in pieces and pierced the dragon. So Rahab is parallel to the dragon. Everybody got those two? Psalm 89, 8 through 11, and Isaiah 51, 9 to 10. Also Psalm 74, 13 to 14. Psalm 74, 13 to 14 mentions the sea serpent or sea monster parallel with Leviathan. Says God crushed, past tense, the heads of Leviathan. Psalm 104:26, you formed Leviathan to play in the sea. And there's other verses on sea monsters too. Genesis 1:21, Job 7, verse 12, am I the sea or a sea monster? Right, he asks God. In other words, and the thing is he really a threat to God's purposes? That's what Job is saying. Am I a sea monster? And the sea monster would stand for the things that oppose God's purposes. Okay. Job 7, verse 12. And of course, there are more, like this one, 9, verse 13, and others. Okay, here's a couple more. Ezekiel 29:3. And the Ezekiel passage is, again, an interesting one because that one connects it... this serpent with Egypt, all right? And just like Ezekiel 28, which describes the king of Tyre, but then goes beyond it to describe the forces or the spiritual reality behind him, it's similar in 29 verse 3 when it comes to this creature. And then the final one, Isaiah 27:1 as well, Isaiah 27:1, and then finally Revelation 20 verse 2, which ties all those different titles together. Okay, so that's one of the most fascinating little miniature studies of a few verses you get in the Bible, but they're really important for interpreting the book of Job. 20 verse 2. All right. So mortals are mercilessly subject to God. This is quite a section here. Verses 22 to 23 have led many to think that Job is really giving us a God that almost is incompatible with Christianity. Can you see how that might be? There's some atheists who latch onto these verses and say, you see, the God of Christianity, this God of love, does not exist. And the book of Job shows it. Job says, it is all one, therefore I say, he, God, destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he laughs or mocks at the calamity of the innocent. Is that an accurate description of how God governs his world, do you think? Does God laugh at the destruction of innocent people? So Job is trying to describe how God runs the world, right? He's not buying into the friend's philosophy that, oh, it's always rewarding the righteous. No, he's saying everybody dies, basically. Everyone gets destruction. God, and the way he seems to be thinking of it now is that God indiscriminately just, you know, unleashes horrible things on everybody, regardless of whether they're good or bad. And at this point, chapter 9, it's as if that's all there is to it. But, of course, he doesn't know about Satan's role in all of this. However, he does at least know that God is the one who's ultimately sovereign and responsible over all of it. I think he will regret these words later, and that's one reason for saying that he repents in chapter 42, verses 1 through 6. He did say some things that were not the accurate picture of who God really is and what he's doing in the world. So this is probably one of those sections that he, you know, realized later on when God talks to him about creation, that he really overstated it, and that's what he repents of. So the problem is that we're not in a position to know all the hows of God's governance of the world, right? We just aren't in a position to judge that. Job, from his position, sees how he doesn't deserve what happened to him, and he kind of infers that this must be the way the whole world is, that nobody gets what they deserve, that there is no justice, and that God never exercises anything justly, and perhaps God himself is unjust, even laughing when innocent people have horrible things happen to them. So that's where he steps a little bit too far, and what he repents of later. He sees in verses 32 to 35 that mortals need a mediator. In verse 33, Job sees the need for someone with access to God to speak up on his behalf. The ESV says there is no arbiter. Other translations actually, you know, make it more of a longing, where it says, "Would that there were an arbiter or a mediator between us." He recognizes that he cannot compel God to vindicate him. He could not stand up to God's questions in court. So he needs a judge or an umpire between him and God. But the problem here is he's putting God on trial. And again, he's not in a position, as far as the knowledge that Job has, he's not in a position to really bring God to court like that. In Genesis 31:37, you get the clear sense of what this mediator figure is. It's the story of Jacob and Laban, his uncle, and he's asking for a mediator between them. But here's it kind of gives us a clear picture of what the term means. Genesis 31:37. Okay, so then Jacob became angry and berated Laban. Jacob said to Laban, "What is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? For you have felt through all my goods. What have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between us too." All right, so you don't see the term there, but it actually is in the verse, and it has to do with the person who decides between the two parties. So Job's got a complaint against God. It's like a court scene, and there needs to be an arbiter in between to make the decision, to declare Job righteous, right? But you know, the implication would be that God is not just, and so it's raising some pretty serious accusations against the character of God. And again, at the end, God asks Job, "Would you put me in the wrong in order to assert your own righteousness?" And there again is something Job backs away from and repents of in the end. So the Holy Spirit was inspiring Job, though. He sees the need for a mediator, right? And 1 Timothy 2:5, does anybody know what that verse tells us about the role of Jesus? There's one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. He's not the mediator who, you know, judges between God and us necessarily, like, you know, maybe that's more what Job was hoping for, but he does bridge the gap between us and God, because in Jesus God came to us, and it's through him he is the ladder to heaven. He says you will see the angels ascending and descending on me, because Jesus is the stairway to heaven. And so he's the one who gives us access to the courtroom of God, the throne room of God. And so that longing of Job is answered in Jesus, as so many things are in the book. To Job, it was obvious that God did not govern by strict adherence to the principle of retribution. You know, he knew that was not true. So he concluded that God's government must be arbitrary, capricious, and cruel. His feeling at this point is that there is no order, not that there's order in the world with exceptions, but that there is just simply no just order at all. He's only looking at the evidence in front of him, which is his own plight. Okay, let's get into chapter 10 and finish up here. Chapter 10, verses 1 to 18, he's pouring out his despairing complaints to God. He wonders, does God enjoy afflicting Job? He wonders if God takes pleasure in what he's doing to Job. What do you think? What's the answer to that? No, but what does God take pleasure in? The final product, and the fact that Job's character is going to be proven as gold. You know, even Job himself says, "When he has tried me, I will come forth as gold," and God does take pleasure in that. And do you think God would ever have allowed this to happen to Job if he didn't know the outcome ahead of time? No, right? He's not cruel in that sense. He knows the good. He knows of the outcome, and that's why he allows it to happen. He knows every possibility and every outcome. There's a great section in Lamentations 3, verses 31 to 33 that encouraged me when I was at a low point in life, and maybe this is something you guys can take with you too. Lamentations 3, there's a great assurance here. Now, this was written again. It's a lament for the fact that Israel is in exile, right? That they've just gone through horrible things. And it says in, let me start in verse 25. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. Let him sit alone in silence when it is laid on him. Let him put his mouth in the dust. There may yet be hope. Let him give his cheek to the one who strikes, and let him be filled with insults. For the Lord will not cast off forever, but though he cause grief, he will have compassion, according to the abundance of his steadfast love. For, and listen to this, he does not willingly afflict or grieve the children of men. So when we talk about the will of God, we've got to maintain at least two different senses of it. We know that some people do suffer according to the will of God. It says in 1 Peter, right? It says, let those who suffer according to the will of God entrust themselves to a faithful Creator while doing good. So for some people, God does in one sense will that they suffer. But at the same time, he doesn't bring that about willingly in the sense that he takes pleasure in it, right? That's the key distinction. There's certain things that God wills because they're necessary, they must be, but he never calls those things good in themselves. It's the result that is good, and he wills it in the sense of the final product, as you put it, what it leads to, but he does not take pleasure in it. That's why we can be assured that he doesn't willingly afflict or grieve the children of men. It's not the grief itself that he wills, but the final outcome. So there are such things as necessary evils, but you can also see them as instrumental goods, because God wouldn't do those things unless they were necessary. Again, another verse, Isaiah 53, verse 10, it pleased the Lord to crush him, but it was his will again in the sense that this sacrifice of Jesus was necessary for the salvation of all. And it was God himself offering himself on our behalf. So in this fallen world, there are some necessary evils which God works together to accomplish the highest good for all. Now, Job wonders about some things here that are so... he has such foresight into the modern situation we find ourselves in now. You guys are familiar probably with the with the problem of evil, and it's really a problem for the character of God and the character of God as we see him in Christianity. Okay, we hold three things about God to be true. God is all-knowing. He is all-powerful. And he is all-loving, or God is love. God is loving. Okay? So if God is all-knowing, if he knows everything, and God is all-powerful, and God is all-loving, then why is there suffering in the world? Here's how it goes. Because if God was all-knowing, he would know how to do away with suffering. If God was all-powerful, then he would be able to do away with suffering. And if God was all-loving, then he would want to do away with suffering. Okay, so therefore, why suffering? And there's the things that Job explores here. He asks in verse 5 of chapter 10, is God finite? In other words, no omnipotence. Because if you do away with omnipotence, then that's one way out of the problem, right? Because God may know everything, he may love, but yet he just simply isn't able to overcome the things that are causing the pain, right? And some people who call themselves Christians actually do believe in this kind of thing, that God has limited his power on purpose, and that he just simply isn't able to do anything about pain and suffering in the world.
Can you repeat what you said?
Which one?
You said he's all-knowing, something.
Oh, just the progression of the problem of evil? Okay. If God is all-knowing, then he would know how to do away with suffering. If God is all-powerful, then he would be able to do away with suffering. And if God is all-loving, then he would want to do away with suffering. Therefore, why are we suffering? And so when you say there is suffering, therefore God is either not all-knowing. There is suffering, therefore God is either not all-knowing, all-powerful, or he's not all-loving, right? Because maybe he knows everything, maybe he can do everything, but he just doesn't really give a care about any one of us and doesn't care if we suffer. And Job seems to be, in chapter 9 and 10, coming down on this one, that even though God is all-knowing, all-powerful, he doesn't really care about people. So that's what he's toying with, sort of. So he asks in verse 5, is God finite? And then he asks in verses 8 to 18, God made Job, so why is he now destroying? So that would be, no love or no omnibenevolence on God's part. And then in verse 4, I skipped this one, are God's vision and knowledge faulty? Which would be no omniscience, right? So isn't it interesting how Job hits on every one of those? These are the exact same ways that it's formulated today by people who argue against Christianity. And the most popular atheistic argument is from the problem of evil or the problem of suffering. So, any ideas on how we maintain all three of these things? How can we maintain our belief in this God we believe in, who's all three of these things? Yeah.
Well, I just see, in light of all of that, and considering who God is, then obviously suffering is a perfect tool in his hands.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, there may be, and we believe there are, some things that aren't possible to achieve as far as God's purpose, if the world had no suffering in it, right? So it's just necessary, but it's within God's hands, and he'll use it for good or turn it for good, yeah?
I was just going to say, I think it's also like a misconception of love. It's not just like warm and fuzzy, but God loves, therefore he allows the suffering to make a better result.
Yeah, and we don't want to take just this thing right here that I'm about to say as like the only solution we say to anybody about this whole issue, because it is complex, and you don't want to rely on one argument, but it's like... If one of my kids gets injured or something like that, and they require stitches, right? I have to take him to the hospital, and from the child's perspective, it doesn't seem very loving that I would hold them, and I've had to do this, while the doctor puts a needle into them, which is painful, right? So the doctor inflicts pain, which doesn't appear to be loving, but it's actually for a good purpose. All right? And so there is a truth in that with what God is doing in the world today, is that he allows suffering. He can even turn suffering and pain around and use it for a good purpose, which, leads to his ultimate purpose being accomplished in the world. So that's one line of argument. So it is the case that he does know everything, and part of his knowledge is knowing what it takes to accomplish his final goal for this world. And he is able to bring it about, and he is all-loving. That's why he's doing it in the first place. But there are times in our experience that we don't really see his love operating at that moment, even though in the final, we can look back and see that it was for good. Yeah.
What's good old freedom of choice? If he's all loving, he would give us the freedom to choose. And, to be able to choose something other than him is the other option.
Yeah, and so that would be the free will defense, that because God values a human being who's able to choose good or evil, then some things, you have to have the possibilities of a person choosing evil, and pain and suffering results from that. The problem is what people or atheists often bring up about this is that, well, some things have nothing to do with human choices. The tsunami that killed hundreds of thousands of people a few years ago, I mean, whose choice was responsible for that? And some people believe that all, any natural catastrophes only happened after the fall. That before that there was no pain of any kind, but others believe that natural processes like earthquakes are essential to life on Earth, and so they have to have been there all along, right? So it depends on your scientific view of that whole thing, age of the Earth and so forth. So, and most atheists are not going to be young Earth creationists, obviously, so that argument doesn't hold up with such people, but yeah. Right, and some of it, you're right, is a result. But there's plenty of cities that, nobody knew there was an earthquake fault there, and you couldn't be expected to know that an earthquake was going to strike that exact spot either. I don't think that would really convince a lot of people. Yeah?
I think we can answer that, objection by saying, well, he is doing something about it. He knows what to do.
Exactly.
He's powerful enough to do it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the greatest thing proving that God has done something about evil and he is going to do something is Jesus himself. Because God did act in Jesus at the cross to deal with sin. It says in Hebrews, he did come once to deal with sin, but the second time he's coming for judgment and to set everything right. Yes. Right.
I think that's one place we can start from with an atheist. No, suffering is not all bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you show up the cross and watch Christ did that.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sometimes it's you know, like I can, you probably have things in your life too that you can see that this was hard, this was painful, but if it weren't for that, this good would never have happened. You know, and it's such a blessing to be able to see that. However, there are times when you can't see the good that comes of it. You don't know what specific good is coming from the specific evil, but yet we can trust God that there must be some good that's coming of it. Even if it's just the ultimate achievement of God's purpose, you know, and the resurrection eventually happening, you know, and all the suffering being necessary for that purpose. Even if it's just a general thing, we still have the assurance that there is a good reason for it. And the fact that God himself came to sacrifice himself for us, that he suffered in the Son on the cross for our sake, shows us that there must be a reason. Because if God himself counted it worth the cost, then we can as well. There must be a reason. We see that God himself, it cost him as well. So
we can initially say that suffering is part of God's plan to suffering is just another process of doing God's will.
What do you mean by that exactly? Explain
God,
a little more.
God allows suffering so that, I mean, obviously, in the end, his will is going to be done. So he uses suffering for his benefit then.
We just have to be careful not to oversimplify it too much. I mean, we have said and agreed that that it is part of God's plan that suffering is part of this world right now, right? And there are some. The way I would put it is that there's no feasible world that was possible in which God's greatest good could come to all people, or the maximum number of people, without suffering being a part of it. Right? Does that make sense? The problem is we don't want to slip into being like Job's friends that go around with pithy saying, you know, this is God, you know, you actually just lost everything and, you know, your life is horrible and you're suffering and your kid just died because God's, you know, this is his will and it's good or something. You know, that doesn't comfort a person. So, but in general, you know, we can have the faith that eventually it's all working together for good. But even though it says in the Bible, like, for the moment, it's not pleasant. We don't try to say, oh, this is actually a good thing right now that your kid just died of leukemia. You know, that we don't want to be insensitive like that because then we're just like Job's friends. Exactly. Yeah, Revelation 20 and 21 are great for that final assurance. But like you said, from God's perspective, how do you think he feels about suffering? And maybe to answer that question, you're going to do an assignment this week on John chapter 11. You know, and just think about the fact that Jesus wept. It wasn't that he didn't know he was going to raise Lazarus back to life again, right? But you know, suffering is something that really only humans can fully experience, not animals, because it's an aspect of your knowledge. Suffering happens when you're aware of it as suffering, right? It's not just the physical pain. It's the awareness of it and your ability to process it mentally, and that's something really only humans can do. So if God is omniscient, then, you know, suffering is an aspect of that. So you don't say, it's kind of heretical to say that God the Father suffers, but the Son came to us in Jesus, and he suffers because the Son suffered on the cross, right? So it's still accurate to say that God suffers or that God weeps with us in our pain. So, yeah, just have to be careful about how you define that, right? Because God is not finite. So there will be much more on that theme, right? We're going to be learning more about this as we go along, but there's a little introduction. And you can see Job touches on it. He hits the key points, right? He questions God's all-knowing, his ability to see everything and know everything. He questions, is God not able to do anything about this? And really the thing he struggles with is just God create him just for the sake of destroying him and cutting him off, which would really seem like God wasn't loving. All right, so your homework is, as I said, you read the book of Job 11 to 14. Those will be the chapters for next week. We have four chapters next week. This week we got through five chapters, which is good. We're covering big ground here. And then do faith versus evil study number two, and that is on John chapter 11, Lazarus, okay? And in this story, you're going to be thinking about the challenge to Mary and Martha's faith, right? So that's what you really want to focus on. Not so much Lazarus' faith, because, you know, he was dead, but Mary and Martha, you know, what was it like for them as, you know, as the story unfolds, as they send a word to Jesus and he doesn't come, their brother dies while they're waiting for Jesus to come and all that. So, yeah. Yeah, the whole books of 1st, 2nd Peter, suffering is a big theme there, and you're hearing it from a person who went through quite a bit. I wanted to tell you that on the handout regarding the faith versus evil studies, there's some inaccurate information, which is totally my fault for not updating. The bottom section talked about submitting late homework and how you have to print it and turn it in class and all that. That's outdated. It should say your summaries must either be printed and turned in before class, or submitted on Populi before the due time, which is like 9 o'clock on Tuesday mornings, okay? So you can submit it either way. It's perfectly fine. It does need to be typed. And the late work, if it's late, basically, you can't upload it. You have to bring it to class. And then for each class session, each week it's late, is 20% off. Okay? Got it? And so every week it's late, it goes down 20%, but it's still very much worth it. If you can't get it done on time, do it the next week. All right. Yeah. If it's less than 2 pages, then you will probably lose some points. Wait, is it supposed to be 1, 2 pages? So actually, yeah. But the key is to do a thorough job, like to thoroughly treat the problem for faith, and to thoroughly treat the solution, and to, you know, do a good application. So you could have 2 pages and not say anything, and you're not going to get a perfect score. Right, you can fill up space with all kinds of stuff, but if it's not solid content, then don't expect a good grade. All right. Yes, Nancy.
Just a quick announcement. You guys, from now on, make sure that everything that you submit is in PDF format. Otherwise, if it's not in PDF format and you don't know how to do it, and you have questions on that, you can come see me in my library hours on Mondays between 1 and 3. But otherwise, it will be considered late, because I won't be able to open it. And so you are warned now. And, well, not warned. Yeah. Notified. Have it in PDF format.
Yeah, and if you have a Mac, it's pretty straightforward. You either do save as and switch the kind to PDF, or you do print and then do, you go to print and then do print PDF, and it saves the file that way. From a PC, it may not be built into like your Word program or something, but you can download a thing called Primo PDF, which is like a PDF printer. And so you just, after you install that, you just go to print and then use Primo PDF, and it makes your PDF for you, then you can upload that. So if you have problems, there is a write-up on the Populi homepage with a link to the Primo PDF site. All right, but it's a good skill for you to have, saving this PDF.